Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's conversation with 96-year-old Pearl Harbor survivor David Russ Russell of Albany, Oregon, originally from Nebraska and a survivor of the USS Oklahoma, the battleship sunk by the Japanese on December 7, 1941, with the loss of 429 men. In all, more than 2,400 Americans died that day, and Russ witnessed some of the worst of it. Before the break, he told of stealing cigarettes from a nearby stand to fulfill the dying requests of some of the men who, it became clear, were not going to survive. And Russ, once it started to sink in there, what had happened, how did that make you feel? Did it make you angry?
Yes. And back then, everything is kill a Jap, remember? Yeah, everything advertising was kill a Jap. Now, it's altogether different. They're the greatest people on earth, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the Japanese people.
So you see all these who've been killed, who've been wounded, and then you look out and you see your ship and it's upside down.
Yeah, no home, no place to eat, no clothing, no showers.
Everything you had is on that ship. So what'd you do?
After I left Fort Allen, I went over to the receiving station and checked in because I knew they'd reassign us someplace. So we'd look at every day they'd post on the bulletin board the names of people where they'd be assigned. So about the third or fourth day, the ship that I went aboard, it was still at sea at the time. So I think on December, I can't remember the dates, but it was quite a while after that the ship came in. And I still didn't have anything to wear. And I had sort of looking for handouts to eat at the receiving station there.
Wow. And you had mentioned you had an uncle on this ship. When did you find out what happened to him?
Well, my uncle from Hickam Field, he and I were visiting there on the receiving station, and pretty soon I saw my uncle walking up from the submarine base, and he had whites on. And as soon as I saw him in whites, I knew what had happened. Because, see, they were just covered with oil when they took them out.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, the uniform was shorts. And when you have whites on, you know, back when the war started, you knew what happened.
Well, and then he told you what happened to him.
And that's...
Could you believe what he went through? Can you share that story with us?
I don't know. If you have claustrophobia, you wouldn't want to hear it. Yeah, the upside down and no lights. Can you imagine? And you're just waiting for that water to build up and the oxygen disappearing.
And this could have happened to you not gone up when you went up.
Could have, yes.
So he's trapped in a ship that's turned over and... compartments are filling up with water. He's running out of oxygen. How long was he down there?
30 hours.
30 hours. And then they cut him out.
And no lights.
No lights. And plenty of guys around him who are hurt, who are wounded, who are dead.
Yep. Floating around, yep.
What did that do to hear him tell that story to you?
My uncle, it was pretty hard on him. When we got into surface action, he sort of went to, he was shell-shocked.
How could you not be going through that?
Yeah. And so they had to discharge him, yeah.
And I don't know if you can give us this perspective or not, but you've been an Oklahoma survivor for 75 years, and you've talked to a lot of other guys who are on your ship. You've got books about it. You know the story as well as anybody. How amazing, how remarkable, how unlikely is it that your uncle and almost another 36 guys did survive for that long in a capsized ship?
It's hard to believe. And the way they survived was they tapped on the bulkhead to see if there was any water in there or not to find out what compartment they wanted to go into before. But as soon as they opened the hatch to go into another compartment, it started filling up too. But that's how they survived from compartment to compartment, yeah.
Can you give us a sense of what you saw? You told us about what you saw at the administration building there when they're bringing the dead and the wounded. But if you looked out at Pearl Harbor, that panoramic view, when this is all over, what did you see there?
You still see what happened those days back then. I still picture the Oklahoma capsized there and the fire from the Arizona and the ship settled down, you know, and they just settled down in the 40, 45 feet of water, yeah. But I still see it today, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that devastating? What did it feel like?
Oh, my goodness, yes. You wanted to do something, which we did. I'm pretty proud of that ship I was on that little destroyer. They're little greyhounds, but they sure get around. a lot of high speed.
Well, we're going to hear that ship's story, too. We've seen the images from Pearl Harbor. We've seen the poster that was all over America afterwards with the tattered flag and the smoke going past and Remember Pearl Harbor. We've heard the song, yeah. Sammy Kay Orchestra, Remember Pearl Harbor. Can you help us understand, though, how palpable that feeling was in that immediate aftermath of just how motivated you and all those other servicemen were to do something about it?
Oh, my goodness. That's quite a question to ask.
I mean, do I have that right? Is that what it felt like?
Yeah, it's about it, yeah. Mm-hmm. Devastating, like you said. And I can imagine what my folks were thinking.
Because they didn't know what happened to you.
They didn't know what happened to me. Before I got a letter home, I can't remember when it was, but it's quite a while. Mm-hmm.
So they're back there in Nebraska, and they hear on the radio probably Pearl Harbor's been bombed, and they know that's where you are.
Yeah, everybody, my mom said everything was silent back, and nobody moved. Everybody stayed close to their radio.
And then they may have even gotten the news that the Oklahoma had sunk and still didn't know what happened to you, probably.
They still didn't know, yeah. Right? And then, well, darn well, they knew that a lot of people died on those ships.
So then they didn't know that you were alive until they got a letter from you.
Until they got my letter. Mm-hmm.
And how long was that?
It'd have to be when I got on a destroyer, because I never had anything.
So we're talking maybe even a month after it happened? They didn't know?
Probably right close to it, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, wow. So you get put on a destroyer. It's hard enough for a guy to survive one of his ships sinking, let alone two, let alone the second one sinks on the third anniversary of the first one. I mean, this is kind of a hard-to-believe story you got here, Russ. But
yeah, I think a lot of people, I don't think people believe me sometimes when I tell them. I didn't know it was December the 7th that day when we were sunk. And see what was happening. We had to abandon ship because of the explosions. People were in the water floating around. The kamikazes knocked out our boat. We had two boats that knocked out those boats. Some of the rafts were broken. People were just floating around in their life jackets. And so we went up topside, and we threw everything over that would float. And we had some stages. Those stages we used to paint the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So we saved one stage, and we had one wounded man. So we put this wounded man, after we got in the water, we put him on the stage, and he just paddled away. But anyway, there's still three of us left. And I don't know where the other survivors, the current or the tide, just carrying them out. And so here we are, three of us together, and we were going around this Japanese held island. We were headed out to sea, and I said, oh, my goodness. I thought, sure, the Japanese come and pick us up. They didn't. I think the current was so strong, probably they didn't have a boat to fight it. But anyway, pretty soon there was nothing, no islands out there, nothing but the one we just left. And pretty soon I saw a ship coming over the horizon. I was hoping it was American. It was. It was an American destroyer picked us up.
I want to ask you more about that, but it occurs to me that in those 3 years from December 7th, 1941 to December 7th, 1944, if you're on a destroyer in the Pacific, you saw a whole lot of other things that might stick with you. And were you on a gun crew on the Mayhem,
yes,
too?
Mm-hmm. 5-38, first loader.
Uh-huh. That gets tiring after a while, doesn't it? Picking up those big old shells and over again?
54 pounds.
That's all?
Mm-hmm. But you got to make sure you can't let them wobble around in there because they'd go right up in the air, when they ram it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had to tell you about, we had a few seconds to just relax for a few seconds, just intermittent. I thought, well, I better look around. If you got any time, you look for aircraft. I'm always afraid of aircraft.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking back aft because most of the aircraft always came up behind the stern of the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw something go across my face. And I thought, is that a projectile? And I looked in the water. Sure enough, I saw that splash. And then I saw some more splashes. And then that upset me.
How close did they come to you?
They just went over our heads, yeah.
Didn't hit the ship.
Yeah.
But it got your attention.
Oh, yes. You can't believe it.
What were some of the other places that you guys were with that destroyer?
Well, let's see. Down in New Guinea, we were up in Alaska. When we were in Alaska, it was so foggy, you couldn't see the bow of the ship. That's how foggy it was up there. I don't know where we were, but I know we were out there looking for the Japanese. I remember one time we took some army men aboard ship. We went 500 miles behind the enemy line. Of course, there were other there were some APDs with us, converted destroyers from World War One. Mm-hmm. They converted them over to carry troops, and they had landing craft, LCVPs.
Yeah.
I think they carried eight. So anyway, 500 miles behind the Japanese line, making a landing at Los Negros, but we survived.
Did you get used to it? Did you get used to being fired at, to have enemy planes or enemy shells or torpedoes heading your way?
Well, we didn't want to go through it again, but you have to be brave. You can't just let yourself down and hide. You got to just stand out there and get with it. That's what we did. Everybody, it's remarkable what these sailors can do when they have to.
Maybe this is a dumb question, but were you scared? Did you ever think, hey, I might not make it through this? I might not make it home to my family?
Many times.
Yeah?
Many times. It's just snap of a finger, you'd be gone.
I mean, I've heard a lot of different answers. Some guys say, no, I was never afraid. I just knew I was going to get there. Another guy said, I can't believe I did.
I was always afraid.
Yeah?
We didn't want to die. Who wants to die? Yeah, when you think about it.
And you had seen enough that did.
Yeah, and they were still young men.
Was there something that gave you hope or kept you going or made you believe that you might make it?
When you do it so many times, it's just one of those things, you just roll it off your shoulders and be brave. And
what would you say was the hardest thing to deal with?
The dead.
You had to confront that on the first day of the war and many more times throughout the war. And as for that capture of Los Negros Island in the Admiralty Islands northeast of New Guinea that Mr. Russell and the destroyer USS Mahan were supporting in February of 1944, it was an often overlooked but strategically significant move that experts say shortened the Pacific War by at least a month. General Douglas MacArthur himself was there on the cruiser Phoenix. The Mahan was one of nine destroyers that, along with those APDs Mr. Russell mentioned, carried troops to Los Negros, not knowing whether the island was really defended or not. So it was a stealthy, quick-strike invasion that carried a real risk of the unknown, but turned into a key success, and the destroyer Mahan was a big part of that. I have links to information about that battle for you at hometownheroesradio.com, and you'll also find connections to the Battle of Ormoc Bay, which would prove to be the last for the Mahan and two other American destroyers. Your destroyer was sunk December 7th, 1944, and it was just peppered with kamikazes. And this was before a lot of people even knew what a kamikaze was. I mean, it wasn't until a few months later that they really came in swarms in places like Okinawa and other spots there in the Pacific. Had you ever seen a kamikaze attack before that day?
In 1942, we were in this battle of, we lost a carrier that day and a destroyer, and I saw a plane hit a destroyer. I just thought somebody shot it down and hit the destroyer. But I look back now, was it a kamikaze attack then? Makes me wonder.
Maybe. But this wasn't something you guys were really prepared to consider, that they would crash intentionally into your ship.
Well, one time we had this Baka bomber came in. It's just an open pit plane with a big bomb in front of it. And you could hear it flying around out there just above the water trying to hit a ship. And that's when your hair stands up on end. I don't know why, we're so used to planes flying, enemy aircraft coming in, but it's scary. In Japan, baka means crazy.
Yeah, very aptly named.
and I was down at the VFW the other day, and I was talking to a guy, and he's talking about the baka bomber. And I said, I ain't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, because you live to tell the story, and we're going to dive into that story of the sinking of the destroyer USS Mahan on December 7th, 1944, 3 years to the day after Russ's ship, the Oklahoma, was lost at Pearl Harbor. You can find photos of this 96-year-old survivor at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've captured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU. The credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.